When Congress created the so-called Section 809 panel, named for a provision in the Defense Authorization Bill, it wanted a comprehensive look at how to reform defense procurement. In the Commission's first of three reports covering commercial items procurement, that's what it's getting. Commissioner Dave Drabkin says many of the recommendations pare back the buildup of barnacles since the last major reform back in the 1990s.
Barnacles might be an excellent description. Over 100 times we've amended the FAR to deal with commercial items since 95. We started with 57 clauses, and as of 2017, there were 165. Not any of them making things more commercial. And so our report suggests going back to where Congress originally intended. Then we talked about contract compliance and audit. There have been a lot of complaints about the role of DCAA in government contracting. A lot of contractors complain that they can't get their incurred costs audited on time. Others complain, both contractors and citizens, that DCAA is more interested in being an external auditor than an internal auditor. Contracting officers complain that they can't get internal audit advice because of DCAA's focus. And so we make a number of recommendations to, one, realign DCAA's mission with what it originally was, which is to be a trusted advisor to the contracting officer.
Because of the DCAA sclerosis, I guess, if you could call that's my word. I understand it's not your word. But contractors have a lot of cash tied up that they don't get in a timely way.
And so does DOD. They have got cash exposed that they haven't been able to close out because it's taking so long to complete the audit process on the back end. But it's also affecting the time it takes for contracting officers to get advice on negotiating and signing contracts. And again, so I think you'll find that our recommendations address ways to shorten those time frames, realign DCAA's mission so that it supports the contracting officer and performs what you would call in the commercial world the internal audit function. You know of SOX, the Sarbanes-Oxley. It requires every publicly traded company to have both internal audit capability and external audit capability. And right now, contracting officers don't have that internal audit capability.
So this would not be throwing money and increasing DCAA to make it more efficient at doing what it's doing now, but fundamentally realign what it does with the resources it has?
Yeah, we're not proposing an increase in the size of DCAA. As you point out, we are recommending that it realign its function and mission so that what the contracting officer needs to have done gets done. By the way, in that same process, we accommodate the concept of the use of third-party auditors at appropriate times and places in the process.
We're speaking with David Drabkin, commissioner of the Section 809 panel, and marching through here, earned value management. What's the issue there?
Well, the issue is that when it's applied to agile development of software, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It was intended for what I believe they call waterfall development, and there's two very different concepts, and particularly in the IT world today, they use agile development. And so, the software that they apply, the methods that they apply, are not helpful when you're buying software and using this agile development process.
Okay, services contracting is the biggest ticket item, I guess, for DOD. And you've got some chapters on that one.
Right. Well, the services contracting, as you know, I think the number this year was 53% of DOD's budget was spent on buying services. And one of the big issues, not the only issue, because we'll be addressing more in this area, but a big issue is the difference between personal and non-personal services. And so we've made recommendations to help reduce the issue and problem with the terminology personal and non-personal services so that DOD can get on about doing its business without creating fictions in order to comply with language that doesn't represent how the economy operates today.
Yeah, personal services is kind of an odd term in the first place in this context.
Well, actually,
it sounds like a barber.
No, actually, a barber is an example of non-personal services. It goes back to a time back in the 20s or 30s where in the government they wanted to make sure that you didn't try to avoid the government personnel system. If you work for 366 days on personal services, that statute says that you are now a federal employee with all the rights and benefits of a federal employee. Well, and there was a time when many people wanted to be a federal employee because of our retirement system, because of our medical benefits, et cetera. Not so much anymore. Our retirement system is not as attractive. And so that's one issue. The other issue is, you know, we have lots and lots of contractors sitting side by side with government employees and uniformed services personnel. And the question is, how do you manage them when they're all essentially doing the same mission that required additional help? And so part of the issue we're addressing here, and as I said, we'll come back to finish this in our next report, is eliminating this barrier to the management of the mixed workforce that we find we have today.
Okay, and small business, huge area, many tentacles to that one.
And we think small businesses are essential to the ability of the department to deliver lethality to the warfighter. They're essential to providing new capabilities, to obtaining technical dominance and maintaining technical dominance. But our approach to small business has been focused on achieving certain goals without respect to whether or not those goals help us achieve our mission. And so what we've proposed is that the department make a pivot. Instead of focusing its attention solely on whether or not we've got 23% of small businesses or five or whatever it is for the particular categories, we want them focused on finding companies who can help us deliver the technologies we need in order to counter the potential threats we face from adversaries, both state and non-state. And small businesses have that capability. But instead, what we have done is focused on non-value-added resellers or others. Now, that doesn't mean that we're proposing not achieving the goals, and we're going to address how we do that in Volume 2 of our report. But it does mean that we want to take advantage of the tremendous capabilities that small businesses have for research and development, and we want the department to be able to do that and focus on doing it. And so we've recommended, in addition to the pivot, increasing certain funding. Now, it doesn't mean we've recommended an increase in the Defense Department's budget. We've recommended within that budget an increase in funding for what's called the SBIRS program, the Small Business Innovation Research Program, and the Rapid Innovation Fund, the RIF Fund. We heard when we walked Silicon Valley and up and down I-66 and in Austin, Texas, and in Boston and Huntsville, where technology and in Illinois, when we're talking to other manufacturers with other capabilities, was they knew there was a Department of Defense. They didn't know how to get there.
Now, in this first report, 600 pages or so, you're also asking Congress to undo some of the reporting and creative work, you might say, it has done with defense over the years. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, let's make sure we're clear. We're not telling Congress anything. Congress has asked us to put together recommendations to it on how to improve the acquisition process. And one of the things that we think they could do and why we've recommended to them is help us clean up the statutes that apply to the Department of Defense Because in some cases they create confusion, in other cases they impose restrictions which Congress intended some years ago, but which may not be relevant in today's environment. So in that regard, in our report, you'll see a section on statutory offices. And it's really important to understand that we're not recommending that the offices be eliminated. We're recommending that the statutory requirements to have the offices be eliminated, leaving the secretary with flexibility. He can keep the offices or he can eliminate the offices, but he doesn't have any flexibility if the statutes don't sunset or go away. And in many cases, these offices, the secretary didn't need a statute to give him the authority to create those offices. And then in the following section in the report, we talk about reporting requirements. And both Congress and the department have had discussions for many years over these statutorily required reporting requirements. And what we've identified here, without making any value judgment about the reports, are reporting requirements which either the department has never submitted a report and Congress hasn't missed it, or the reporting requirement is old and one questions if you still need that reporting requirement. But again, it's not a value judgment. It's just a recommendation to help clean up these requirements so that the department will have the freedom to operate. And by the way, nothing prevents the department, if it still wants the report for itself, from keeping the report. It's just eliminating the statutory requirement for it.
So in this first report, how many recommendations do you think are in there individually? Do you have a tally of that?
I think the number I counted was 79, but keep in mind that you'll find only 22, but it's 22 in like 79 parts. Because one recommendation, for example, has 26 sub-recommendations.
And in embarking on this whole process, you had a committee and you did a lot of research. I mean, this is not just Dave Drabkin. How did you manage to just not come up with what you may have had in your mind as an obvious change? How did you make sure that the oddball idea or the left field idea or the really creative idea got into this and it wasn't just reaffirming what everyone always says about defense procurement?
Well, first of all, as I think when last time we spoke, I pointed out that after the secretary was directed to create the office, he appointed 18 commissioners. Those 18 commissioners are divided into 10 plus one teams. Team one's looking at the FAR and the DFARs and the policies. Team two is looking at a whole new way of simplified acquisition. Team three is the commercial team, and you see their report in here. Team four is looking at barriers to entry, what chased folks out of our marketplace, what prevents folks from coming into our marketplace, and we're also looking at the implementation of the dynamic marketplace. The first part of our report, Team 5, is looking at programs that went right and how to replicate them. Team 6 is looking at IT, and they address the defense business systems in this report. Team 7 is looking at the budget process and the fiscal laws applicable to contracts. Team 8 is looking at all the recommendations that come in, including the 50 worst recommendations, which, by the way, we have now received 90, I think it's 90 separate recommendations, and we're reviewing every one of them. Team 9 is looking at cost accounting standards, and their report, I think, will be in the second volume for June. Team 10 is looking at our workforce issues, and the plus one is helping us look at things like reorganizing Title 10, which hasn't been really organized for procurement since 1947 with the Armed Services Act of 1947.
And we should point out that you recited all of those teams and the responsibilities from memory.
Well, we've been working at it for a while. And so in response to your question, it wasn't the result of any one person's ideas. We We did research. We did both documentary research, looking at various laws, regulations, rules, looking at articles which talked about how an acquisition system ought to function. We talked with people from various companies, from various associations, and from government itself who are doing the job. We sat and worked with our professional staff, which supports the 18 commissioners, and we have about 30 of those folks. About half of them actually are detailed to us. And so we had a rather lengthy process, which all kind of percolated up to recommendations which the panel as a whole reviewed and then voted on. And I think I can say accurately that every recommendation received much more than the minimum required in terms of votes. There were very few where there were any negative votes at all, but those are the recommendations we've prepared. And one of the guiding principles we had was not to limit ourselves by what we think would be accepted, but to recommend what we think ought to happen, giving Congress the space to decide whether our recommendation is to a bridge too far, or whether they like that bridge too far and they want to adopt it. Same thing for the secretary. Many things that we recommend to Congress in this report, the secretary could do himself without congressional direction. But the mandate for us is to provide these reports and recommendations to the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee.
We're speaking with Dave Drabkin, the commissioner of the Section 809 panel. What's the timetable for Volume 2 of the recommendations, and is that the last one, or are there three?
No. This was the first volume of three. Congress has directed us in its amendment to our initial establishment and the FY18 Armed Service NDAA to produce two other reports. Our next report is due June 30th, and then the final report is due January 15th or 31st? 15th. It's due the 15th. And we fully intend to meet all those dates. We're working this week, in fact, on developing the outline for Volume 2. We've got lots of work, but the question is, what can we get ready for prime time, and how do we put it together so that it makes sense, and so that Congress, if it chooses, can use it, some of which might wind up in the FY19 NDAA. The remainder may well not get acted on until the FY20 NDAA. And of course, the SecDef can act on this anytime he wants.
Do you feel confident this won't go the way of so many commissions over the years that just end up as shelfware, but there's really an appetite for getting these into the next couple of NDAAs and maybe in the Pentagon to take some action?
Well, we know that at least our interim report, which we submitted last May, every one of our recommendations wound up in the FY18 NDAA. But more importantly, unlike other commissions in the past, we're actually providing Congress with the language they need, if they like our recommendation, to implement in the work they do. So when you look at our report, part of the reason it's so lengthy is we actually provide where statutes need to be changed, the statutory language to change it. That is a big difference between our report and most others. The only other report in recent history, of course, recent to me is different than it is to some of your listeners, was the Section 800 panel report of 1993. If you look in that report, it had statutory language to implement. We know that Congress is interested because they've summoned us to the Hill and they've expressed interest in what the staffers have expressed interest. Of course, you know, this is all a question of what fits in their view of the world. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Mac Thornberry, has expressed publicly an interest in continuing his reform of the acquisition process. I don't think he's had a chance to look at our report yet, but I know some of his staffers has because that's who we met with. A combination of both their expressed interest and the fact that we're giving people the means to implement our recommendations if they agree with them.